Hello, I'm Terrence McNally, and welcome to today's podcast.
I was 23, a couple of years out of college in 1972, when I packed all my belongings in a used van and traveled to Mexico. I was going to go to San Miguel de Allende and become an artist. I was, for the first time, letting myself do that. I created the most idyllic life, surrounded by beauty and nature, living with a few other would-be artists and yoga folk, and buying fresh fruit every day in the Mercado. But each week, I got the International Time magazine, and each day, I read the International Trib, and I saw a little-known senator from South Dakota, at first exceeding expectations, and then actually winning Democratic primaries. I read whatever I could get my hands on. Decades before the internet, of course, in addition to his pledge to begin withdrawing U.S. troops from Vietnam on Inauguration Day, he was for universal health care, a guaranteed minimum income, tax reform. Not only that, his was a grassroots campaign, not controlled by the party bosses or the professionals, one in which someone like myself could actually make a difference. I couldn't resist. I left paradise, drove back to the States in time to work the last two primaries in California and New York, and the convention in Miami. And as a reward for my efforts, I was given the job of running the most conservative Democratic Assembly District in California. At that point, the 52nd Southeast L.A. County, consisting of a few Latinos, a lot of Humphrey-loving unionists who would never forgive McGovern, and to the right of them, Wallace folks. Acknowledging that reality, I was asked to win 37% of the vote. And without a college or a junior college, without a single affluent neighborhood, with a canvassing army of mostly high school students, that's what we did. We got 37%. Unfortunately, that's all the campaign got nationally, losing to Richard Nixon 49 states to one. And in our campaign office in Downey, California, we wept. Well, today, as America is engaged in another unwinnable war, initiated again through government deception, that presidential candidate, George McGovern, is my guest. Here on Freeform, we explore the lives, the work, and the ideas of individuals that I suspect hold pieces of the puzzle of a world that just might work. George McGovern was a decorated World War II bomber pilot. His wartime exploits were at the center of Stephen Ambrose's The Wild Blue. He was a professor at Dakota Wesleyan. He ran the Food for Peace program under John Kennedy, represented South Dakota for two terms in the House, three terms in the Senate. And his opposition, as I said, to the Vietnam War fueled a grassroots campaign that won the 1972 Democratic presidential nomination, only to lose to Richard Nixon. Many members of Nixon's committee to reelect the president later served jail time for Watergate-connected crimes. He's written 9 books, the last two of which were The Essential America, Our Founders in the Liberal Tradition, and his most recent, Ending Hunger Now, A Challenge to Persons of Faith. Welcome, George McGovern.
It's good to be on with you today.
Okay, so you heard my story of how I was just one of the thousands and thousands of McGovern's army.
I was so moved by your introduction and what you did in 72 that I've told my hosts here they have to let me stay here until 25 minutes after the hour, so that'll give us a little more time to talk.
I thank you, and I really do thank you, because I know when 10 minutes ago I was told that I would only have you till quarter after, so thank you very much. I want listeners to get to know the people behind the work, the ideas and the movements and so on. How did you end up running for president, George McGovern?
It was the war in Vietnam. You know, I was a junior senator from a little state with only 3 electoral votes. I don't think that I would have been compelled to get in that race for the presidency were it not for my anguish over what seemed to me to be an outrageously mistaken war in Vietnam. So that was the driving force that brought me into that race.
And this all is spelled out in the film One Bright Shining Moment. But you'd voted for the Gulf of Tonkin, which you say is the decision you most regret in your life. You, however, were an opponent from the very start. And was it just that as you looked around after the 68, in which Nixon had beaten Humphrey, and you looked around prior to 72 and said, someone's got to do it?
That's right. I felt that the case had not been made among the Democratic presidential hopefuls and that somebody had to make that case. We couldn't simply say, well, we're for the war, we can run it better than the Republicans. That didn't wash with me, and I don't think it would have with the American people. Obviously, the Vietnam issue was not the only one, but it was the transcendent issue, and it was tearing this country apart. I honestly believe that until we terminated our mistaken involvement in that war in Southeast Asia, that we weren't going to really be able to address the other problems before the country.
Very clear, very clear. Let me, what I want to do for most of the time I have you today, George, is talk about what that, the lessons of 72 and that period for the present. But before I do, let me ask you this question. Your campaign and the reforms the McGovern Commission instituted in the nomination and convention process are at least partially blamed, have been ever since, for the failures of the Democratic Party ever since. What's your perspective on that, and is there truth to that, or what's the real meaning?
It's a total fiction. You know, those reforms were mandated by the delegates to the 1968 convention. They knew that the party was in a mess. They knew that what was coming across on television was the picture of a party split across the middle over the war and other issues, and that something had to be done to change the way we were picking presidential nominating delegates. For example, in a number of states, not more than 10% of the delegates who were going to nominate our presidential candidate were women. Even though women in every state were slightly more than 50% of the voting public, there were almost no people under 30 on those delegations that went to the 68 convention. Very few blacks, very few Hispanics. All across the board, what you had was a convention largely of middle-aged, middle-class men. Now, I'm not against people like that. I was one myself at that time, but I don't think they ought to dominate the presidential nominating process to the exclusion of women and young people and the minorities. That's not the way American democracy is supposed to work. These people who say those reforms ruin the Democratic Party don't know what they're talking about.
What do you think of the current anti-war movement, both outside and inside the political parties? And let me add, have you seen today's news that both the Republicans and the Democrats in the Senate have proposals on the table right now that call for Iraqi forces to take the lead next year and for the Bush administration to lay out a strategy for ending the war?
Well, I think that's all to the good, and I'm glad it's happening. It's long overdue. This war is going nowhere. We never should have gotten in there. I don't think you should send young Americans out to die in a foreign country unless America's national security is on the line, unless it's essential to the safety and defense of America. Iraq was no threat to us. They had a miserable dictator in charge of the country, but he had done nothing against us and was no threat to us. And we can't send the American army into every country where they have political problems and hope that we can set things aright. We don't have the power or the responsibility to do that. So I'm glad that even since this last election a year ago, I have seen clearly, as I'm sure our listeners have, I've seen a weakening of support for the war. People are beginning to think it was a mistake. And both the parties are now looking for opportunities, I think, to make a graceful exit out of that mistaken war.
Now, are you afraid, as some would be, I think, that recall in 68, Nixon was elected with a secret plan to end the war? And would you be afraid that that some of these moves would be merely to shore up support for the Republicans in 2006 to take the thunder from those who oppose the war in the Democratic Party or further to the left, and yet actually just slightly reduce the quagmire rather than truly change it?
I think some people are motivated exactly by those considerations. They want a face-saving way. Not to say they were wrong in supporting our entry into this war, but a face-saving way to get out of something that they see no end to. I don't think the American people are going to buy that. They saw that Nixon's secret plan to end the war lasted for 4 years, during which 40% of all the Americans who died in the Vietnam War were killed. Almost half of all of our casualties in that war took place after Nixon said he had a secret plan to end the war, and then took another 4 years of fighting and killing and bombing before finally the Congress forced him to terminate our involvement there.
Yes, as you point out in the film, on the day he was elected, he could have done as you pledged to do and begin the withdrawal. Then nothing was gained by the four more years.
And I don't go for these secret plans. That may be the earmarks of a police state. It's not the earmarks of a democracy. I think the American people ought to be told the facts, and the president ought to lay out a plan, a disengagement. I hope that people are not going to buy another one of these so-called secret plans.
Let me read, by the way, I found various quotes from your past, and the acceptance speech you made in 1972 at the Democratic Convention, which I was one of the young folk on the floor there to witness, included these. I'm going to read a few paragraphs, actually, and then I'd like your comments in the view from, as I say, 33 years later. This is the time for truth, not falsehood. In a democratic nation, no one likes to say that his inspiration came from secret arrangements by closed doors. But in the sense, that is how my candidacy began. I'm here as your candidate tonight in large part because during four administrations of both parties, a terrible war has been chartered behind closed doors. I want those doors opened, and I want that war closed. And I make these pledges above all others. The doors of government will be opened, and that war will be closed. This is the time. It is a time for this land to become again a witness to the world for what is just and noble in human affairs. It is a time to live more with faith and less with fear, with an abiding confidence that can sweep away the strongest barriers between us and teach us that we are truly brothers and sisters. From secrecy and deception in high places, come home, America. From military spending so wasteful that it weakens our nation, come home, America. From the entrenchment of special privileges in tax favoritism, from the waste of idle lands to the joy of useful labor, from the prejudice based on race and sex, from the loneliness of the aging poor and the despair of the neglected sick, come home, America. Those were your words in 72. Could you reflect on them now in 2005?
It makes me sad to hear those words spoken so eloquently by you, because when I spoke them, it was 3 o'clock in the morning, and 95% of the television audience was in bed, sound asleep. My mother saw and heard me, my wife, the delegates on the convention floor, but that was one of the tragic errors in that 1972 convention. We let primetime television, primetime radio get away from us. That speech should have been delivered about 9 o'clock or 10 o'clock, somewhere thereabouts, when we had 80 or 90 million people watching that.
Isn't it chilling, though, also to see deception, secrecy, tax privilege?
Yeah.
I mean, all these issues 33 years later.
Yeah, it's sad, because I've been looking through a book of my major speeches of 72. It's called An American Journey. It's published by Random House right after the 72 campaign. And I was looking up a couple of references there, and I started reading those speeches, and they're as relevant today as when they were delivered in July of 1972. We've got very much the same problems: no adequate health care, no just tax system, no straight-out, straightforward discussion of the central problems of the country, an unwise war. You'd think that nothing had happened.
Yeah, like someone could have gone to sleep that night while they were waiting for your speech, woken up today, and nothing would have changed.
That's right. I think Rip Van Winkle would have had a field day with that situation.
Now, let me ask you to look again from your unique vantage point, having led the most grassroots, principled presidential campaign of my lifetime. Watching your campaign in the movie, it struck me not as a fluke, at that point, but as the natural outgrowth of the civil rights movements and the student and the anti-war activism. It made sense that the grassroots would now enter into electoral politics in a big way. Now, what the problem is, though, it looks from the present as if we tried it once. For the first time, inventing it as we went along, we lost to a ruthless, experienced, and wealthy team, many of whom, as I pointed out, ended up doing jail time. And yet, rather than getting a chance to get better at it, we've never had a campaign like it since. It's held up as a failure to be avoided at all costs. If you were talking to a 24-year-old today, what would you tell him or her or millions like them about how to bring that kind of authentic grassroots power to life again and how not to let it die this time?
First of all, tell the truth. That was the key ingredient of the 72 campaign. People were convinced that I was speaking the truth. They didn't argue that I was always right on everything, but they knew that I was proclaiming what I thought was right. I was giving it my best effort to get at the bottom of the central problems before the country and then speak straight out what I thought ought to be the solutions. It's true we lost that campaign, but it triggered in American politics the birth of all kinds of the political movements since then that are still with us. That campaign of 72 wasn't a complete failure. We did force an end to the war in Vietnam. 6 months after the election, Nixon was on the way out of office. Agnew had already resigned. Many people, as you pointed out, were brought to justice and sent off to prison. None of those things happened to anybody in my campaign in 72. It was an honorable, straightforward campaign. We lost, but that doesn't mean that we sacrificed things that were fundamental. We stayed with the truth. We stayed with integrity. I'm going to have to, at this point, face the reality of speech and leave you.
Okay.
I want to tell you how much it means to me to be on this program today, and I hope all your listeners will come see that film that Steve Vittoria has produced. I'm going to be there to greet them.
Okay. Thank you very much, George. Thank you for your time. Thank you for your time over the years since World War II, really. You've been an America hero ever since then. And I look forward to, I'll drop by the theater and meet you this weekend.
Look forward to seeing you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
George McGovern, three-term senator from South Dakota, 1972 Democratic presidential candidate, talking about the lessons of that campaign looked at through the perspective from 30-some years later. And there is a film called One Bright Shining Moment. It's a documentary of George McGovern and that grassroots campaign. It includes a lot of folks speaking both back then and now about that campaign. Oh, I was going to say some of the folks that are in the film. McGovern himself, Gore Vidal, Gloria Steinem, Warren Beatty, Dick Gregory, Gary Hart, Howard Zinn, Ron Kovic. It's narrated by Amy Goodman. And produced, written, and directed by Stephen Vittoria.